good discussion. It was on a subject which Joe Fletcher and some of the rest of you have encouraged over the years, and which is so often neglected in current thought. Some 25 years ago, the Rockefeller Foundation trustees became a little impatient with contemporary social science. They said all that people want to do is count, and nobody tries to explain and interpret. And so some very senior people from a broad spectrum of experience, Robert Lovett, Henry Allen Moe, Raymond Fosdick, John Foster Dulles, all encouraged the then president, Dean Rusk, to establish a grant program in legal and moral philosophy. And that program really generated quite a good deal of interest. The basis for it was that the founding fathers addressed themselves to the underlying issues and problems, but that more and more in contemporary social science, one wasn't looking at the predicates, the assumptions, and the consequences of political thought. Many of the people among the people who were very active in assisting as advisors were Lon Fuller, Paul Freund, people who are great figures in legal thought today. And I was interested that these are the people that Shannon Jordan has had contact with as well in the development and expansion of her thought. She's going to talk with us about the consequences of making fundamental rights a moral issue, a moral question. And that isn't too far removed from the kind of concerns that the founding fathers had about political thought and political theory. She's a graduate of William and Mary. She did graduate work in philosophy and applied ethics at Georgia. University of Georgia. Her interests bridged philosophy and law, and she has continued to work in this area in a very distinguished position at George Mason University. We're especially pleased that she is from George Mason, because I think the Miller Center in the years ahead would hope to have fruitful relations with this emerging intellectual center where so much is happening. And secondly, and this is a very precarious point to make, I know, and one makes it at his peril, but we have not in our forums done a particularly good job in identifying the intellectual leaders who happen to represent the other 50% of the population of the United States. And so in that sense, we're particularly pleased that in addition to being a good scholar, she helps us in that regard. So we'll just follow whatever line you want to pursue, and I know everyone is looking forward also to the discussion.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it. I'm really happy to be here. Last week, when we talked about doing this extra 11 o'clock thing here, I said I'd be happy to do it on the understanding that we're going to emphasize discussion. And so what I want to do is to bring you a problem that I have and let you help me solve it, because I have been very interested in working on the relationship between law and morality. And in just a minute, I'm going to tell you a little bit about how I came to do that work. And how I came to have the problem that I have, and then I'm going to give you the problem and let you help me push on it and see what we can do with it. When I was in graduate school, I began studying applied ethics. I have since found out that some philosophers then think that that's not really very philosophical, and people in the applied fields then think that, well, you're really a philosopher, so you kind of don't belong any particular place. But nevertheless, I keep on doing applied ethics with the firm conviction that if moral philosophy is to have any true value and meaning, that it will have value and meaning for the concrete lives of people, people who are making decisions in medicine and in law and in other applied and practical areas. And what I hope to be able to do is to take some of the long history of beautiful insight and wisdom from the philosophical disciplines, which has very often been, I'm afraid, rightfully accused of being rather ivory tower, and bring it down to where people live and let it inform their lives and their decision making. So I come to work in this area called applied ethics. I began work several years ago on the problem of decision making for incompetent persons. And in pursuing that problem, I quickly realized that the issue was not so much whether or not you should disconnect the machine, but more importantly, who was to be the appropriate decision maker in a case where you were wondering what to do. Obviously, I came to that problem through reading about and being concerned over the problem of Karen Ann Quinlan. Then I realized that there was a group of people called incompetent persons who had this thing called fundamental right to privacy, which they were incapable of acting on in any meaningful way. And so I ended up with this question, well, what does it mean to have a fundamental right if you can't do anything with it? And I decided that I couldn't really solve the problem of who should be the appropriate decision maker where fundamental rights were at issue unless I understood what it meant to have a fundamental right. So I had to go back and do some law work. So I hied myself over to the law school and started hollering help, and a lot of people very generously came forward and said, this is what you need to do. And I began reading in constitutional law. Basically, the way it came down was that I ended up working through the line of substantive due process and equal protection decisions so that I came through cases like Allgaier and Lochner, and then forward to the Meyer and the Pierce school decisions, simultaneously picking up problems like Skinner along the way, and ended up with this fact, I guess, that we have a right of privacy in decision-making about abortion, and a right of privacy in decision-making about birth control, and that we are allowed to decide whom we shall marry. And I sat there with that for a very long time, and I said, what does this mean if a person is permanently comatose? Or what can it mean if a person is a minor? For example, the abortion decision with regard to minors. And as I came to worry over those decisions, I thought, I really didn't learn that law at all. I needed to go back and do it again. I went back the second time. I listened very carefully to the language of the courts. And I'll tell you the end, and then I want to go pick back up this issue about the language that they use. The end result was that I finally decided that when the courts were speaking about individuals possessing these fundamental rights, that what they had essentially done was carve out an area where they said that these questions belong in this area. It was called privacy, and still is in many of the works. But I actually think that privacy issue can be divided off in what I'm talking about as a section of it called autonomous decision-making, if you will. That is, I don't understand the right to decision-making about abortion or termination or refusal of treatment to be so much a matter of privacy as a matter of respect for the autonomy of the individual. But then once again, I'm back with that question, how is Karen Ann Quinlan autonomous? And what kind of meaning or sense could I make out of that? Or a 10 or 12-year-old girl? What kind of sense? Well, I decided that what had actually happened was that the courts had carved off this area and said, this is the moral domain. They don't say it in that language. Okay, I draw that conclusion. This is the moral domain. And in that domain, the state does not have competence and therefore does not have jurisdiction, but that the individual holds a fundamental right. And then we're left with the question that I originally wanted to address, who then exercises that fundamental right on behalf of a person who does not have the capacity to do so for himself. And then at that point, I went through the various alternatives for decision making the state through the court systems, the medical profession, the family, or other what I call primary moral community. I don't want to prejudice my case there. I suggest that, for example, a religious community may be the equivalent of a family, that is the primary moral community for a nun or a priest. And I would even leave it open that in for example, a homosexual union of duration across time, that perhaps the other there would be the primary moral community for that one person. That's the third forum. The other forum that is most popular, actually, these days is the ethics committee in hospitals, although now that we've got a lawsuit pending on that, we may or may not see the ethics committee fall by the wayside. I argued in favor of the primary moral community, most frequently the family, being the appropriate locus for decision-making in those instances because, I said, that it was a moral decision that was being made and that an ethics committee or the state or a physician does not have the proper authority in the ancient sense of that word to make a moral decision for another person. And only in the most extreme situations where there would be no primary moral community, and tragically that does from time to time happen, would the state then intervene and on behalf of that person make a decision. But they would not then be making an essentially moral decision. They would just be making a very limited kind of decision of what shall we do, and it wouldn't have a constitutive meaning for the life of the person for whom it was made. That's the end of the story with what I did about decision-making for incompetent persons. But what I want to do today is to talk to you about the three characteristics that I found consistently running through the language of the courts in the fundamental rights cases, and then tell you about the problem that I have, because although I've got everything nice and tidy and got the book written, the idea continues to plague me, and I wonder if I went further with it in more meaningful and foundational levels rather than just staying on the practical level, what would actually happen. I found these three ideas running consistently through the language of the court. The court consistently characterized a fundamental interest as belonging to the person for a noble purpose. Time and again, that language came up. And in Griswold, for example, Justice Douglas does a wonderful job. He says, marriage is a coming together for better or worse, hopefully enduring, intimate to the degree of being sacred. The association promotes a way of life, not causes, a harmony in living, not political faiths, a bilateral loyalty, not commercial or social projects. Yet it is an association for as noble a purpose as any involved in prior decisions. And that idea of being sacred or being for a noble purpose consistently appears throughout the fundamental interest decisions. The second thing that characterizes the fundamental interest decisions is that time and again the court looks to tradition and what it calls the collective conscience of the people to discover whether or not a claimed interest is to be understood as belonging fundamentally to the person for this noble purpose. In philosophy, we always like to make very extreme examples about everything, but I suppose that a person could say that they have a fundamental right to just about anything. Okay, people do claim rights to the most extraordinary kinds of things these days. And one could perhaps mount that argument. If the court were going to try to discern whether or not the interest was in fact fundamental, then what it would do would be to look to the traditions and the collective conscience of the people so that every passing fancy, no matter how solidly held, would not qualify as denoting a fundamental interest. They're few and they're precious, and the court isn't interested in popular polls or passing perceptions of the age, but they want to look to the very foundations of the society and see how we have, as a people, understood ourselves over the years. The reason that this is so crucial, if some of you do not do law, am I right that we have some non-law people? Okay, the reason that this is very crucial is that the state can limit my freedoms in many ways, And basically, all the state has to do is show that it has a legitimate interest in something that's appropriate for the state, a legitimate goal or end for the state, and say, well, there's a rational relationship, for example, between people going 25 and reducing the number of deaths and the other kinds of carnage that we have on the highway. And so they can interfere with my alleged freedom to go as fast as I want on the highways. They can restrict that if there's this rational interest. But when I have a fundamental right, they cannot do that. They have to show that there is a compelling state reason to justify their intervention. And that's a much stricter standard, so that the limitations on my fundamental rights will be fewer and will be less intrusive than limitations on my other kinds of rights. That's the reason that it's so important. Well, the third point that comes clearly through in the language of the courts is that fundamental interests denote an area where the state just says, we're not competent. For example, we are not competent to decide whether or not a child should go to a Catholic or an Amish or a Baptist or a non-sectarian or a public school. All we are competent to say is that the child will have an education. Okay, but we will not specify the exact contents of that. Needs to make some minimum intrusion into the child's freedom so that he learns to read, do a few numbers, that kind of thing, but I will not say whether or not, or the state will not say whether or not he can learn about God in his daily encounters with his reading lessons. That denial of competence is an admission of the finitude, if you will accept one of those vague philosophical terms, or the limited character of the state. And what the state says is, if we're not competent, then we don't have jurisdiction over that. So we can require that you send your kid to a school, but we will not specify all the content. And that's the third characteristic. Now, as far as that goes, I was able to take it and finish my work on decision-making for incompetent persons, and I think that's fine. But even at the time that I was writing that, I was thinking, gosh, what really is happening here is that this state, this political union, is built on the very foundational premise that, in fact, recognizes that the essential human task is the formation of oneself as an individual moral person, or in grandmother's language, the formation of your character, son, okay? That's the essential human task. And the reason that the state dares not tread in these certain areas is that the state is for a different purpose, which can be found in the preamble to the Constitution. That's the purpose of the state. But the purpose of the state is not to form me as a person. That's my essential human task, and that task is more fundamental, more essential to my being than the formation of the political union itself. If this is true, if this understanding of the essential fundamental nature of human being is true, and if freedom is that essential ingredient, then I'm left with this notion that perhaps what happens is that, in fact, the state admits that morality, or the moral task of being human, is the absolute foundational human task. I'm comfortable with that. After a while, I think, no, I'm not really comfortable with that at all. How does that fit into our very careful separation of legal and moral issues? On the very practical decision-making level, I can come out with, here's the domain of law, here's the domain of morality, give you all the legal cases and the sites and say, all right, now the appropriate forum is the one that makes the moral decision, because that's a moral decision. And I can put that away. But at another level, I become extremely uncomfortable. And here's where my problems arise. I have them in two categories, I guess, and the first has two dimensions to it. If the formation of oneself as a moral person is the fundamental human task, it seems to me not too difficult to trace out that liberal, democratic, pluralistic form of government is the best form of government. I like that. That's comfortable in my living. It's not real comfortable for me philosophically. The reason for that is I can obviously be charged with terrible chauvinism, and secondly, and more importantly, it's uncomfortable to me for this reason. What happens with these fundamental rights is that the state moves out and says, neither the state nor, in the example case, for example, of abortion, or your husband or your parents or anybody else will tell you what you're going to decide in that area. We will not pressure you. And in fact, we've had a series of cases, as you well know, about whether or not showing pictures of the development of the fetus at certain stages is a pressure towards one or another of the alternatives. No pressure. Nobody is going to try to influence, inform, control your decision. And the state will see to that. We'll guarantee that there will not be social or political pressure in that area that's protected as a fundamental right. If we read Walter Lippmann, if we reflect upon some of the really serious social problems that we have today, one of the themes that continually arises to the surface and confounds all of us in all the disciplines, I believe, is that a lack of strong moral input into the development of our young people and a lack of strong, definitive moral commitment in our social and political life seems to be causing us an awful lot of problems. And you can tie that up with any kind of problem you want, from juvenile pregnancies to lack of appreciation for the humanities and the colleges and the universities, and however you want to go with that. It does seem to me that is consistently raised as an issue across the board. And that, moreover, it is understood by sociologists, for example, if you look at Habits of the Heart, Robert Bella et al. Last year, one of the things that you find is that the claim that there's a need to solidify community. But community can only be solidified if there is some commonality, right? Something to make the union with. I don't make a union with you on the basis of the fact that we're on the same bus. I make a union with you on the basis of the fact that we share certain kinds of commitments or certain kinds of understandings or values, and that forms the community. And a community has a kind of strength and power that a group, for example, the group on the bus, okay, definitely it's a group. You can say all those on the bus are different from all those off the bus. That's a group. But they're not a community because they don't have the power that comes from shared commitments, understandings, beliefs. If we don't have some way of maintaining or establishing and maintaining this commonality, then it seems to me that we sow the seeds of our own destruction. And I don't want to overstate the case there, but the evidence that we have from the various social science disciplines does indicate that there is at least a serious problem in that direction. But back to my problem, if we have this moral domain and the state cannot influence it, then where will we find these common values? Shall we just simply rely on parents to pass down these traditions to their children? What about the parents who say, well, honey, religion might be a real good thing, and when you're grown up, you can pick. Those people traditionally do pick not to have a religion. Okay, honey, school is really neat, and if you want to do your homework, that's great. Hey, I was 10 once too, right? I don't want to do my homework, and I don't when I'm given that kind of choice. On the other hand, Mama and Sister Mary, everybody, said you will sit down and do your homework, and if you don't, you will pay this price, and it became cheaper in the bargain for me to do my homework. And over the years of that, I assimilated a kind of value that doing this kind of work has some merit. So there's strong indications from psychology and sociology that if we don't in some way impress these values upon the young, and moreover, if we don't in some way enforce certain kinds of values in a society, that they will be ignored and that we will be, in part, perhaps, sowing the seeds of our own destruction. It's problem number one. The second problem is actually about the relationship between law and morality. Have I come to the conclusion that there is a moral foundation for the political system that we have? I wonder about that, and I wonder why that makes me uncomfortable, but it does. I guess maybe coming out of schools that taught me nice social contract theories that were very tidy and all these rational people got together and say, gee, the way we will get along with each other is that I will exchange this much for that much, okay? So I voluntarily set certain kinds of limits on my freedoms so that I have greater freedom. That is, I can sleep at night because I've agreed with you that we won't steal each other's goods while we're sleeping. And that's rational as opposed to moral. And the social contract theory seems to me to be ultimately based in a theory of rationality. But what I've done is, starting in the middle, admittedly, okay, starting from a real practical problem, working back through the history and looking at the decisions and the language and the way people think about things, have come up with the notion that, no, it's not a totally unbiased, rational, objective foundation that we have. We may be solidly committed to an essentially moral perspective. And if we are, I guess I wonder what that means. So those are my questions. Those are the problems that I have. I was going to start work on this in the spring, and I'm delighted to start work on it right now. So I would be happy for any comments, any flaws you find in my reasoning. I have no ego involvement with the claims that I make or things that I've said. I'm really honestly looking for the best way of thinking about the problem. So as long as you don't criticize my children or tell me that you don't like Victorian collars, I am happy for whatever critiques you would like to make about what I've said.
Well, we have a wide variety of background represented, law school, faculty, situation ethics, diplomatic history, practical business, governmental experience. Who'd like from classics, who'd like from what angle or another to begin our discussions? Norm?
I think what troubles me about the central issues that you raise, and I have no desire to quarrel with anything that you said, but I think what troubles me is the fact that in this whole area of freedom of choice and morality and law, that the problem arises from the fact that certain people relegate to themselves the right to do certain things in the name of freedom and self-development and so on, which could not be applied to everyone. It's a freedom, in other words, that they claim for themselves. Let's take a 14-year-old girl who chooses to become pregnant over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. Well, if she doesn't have any more right to do that than the other 14-year-old girl in the United States. Now, if she has the right to do it, and to have society pay the bill, then every 14-year-old has the same right to do that. And if you have that, you have absolute destruction of the system, the complete collapse of the country, mm-hmm. because it cannot bear that kind of a burden. Mm-hmm. And so the question that I raise really is, how does one get into this area where you begin to raise the question, which you didn't seem to raise, that if one person has a right to do something, that you can't ask the question, why, if she has the right or he has the right, why doesn't everyone have the right? And then what happens to society? And to me, that's the basic question that troubles me about what I read in the papers every day. This relegating to oneself certain privileges and rights, which apply generally, would absolutely destroy the system.
I think that that's generally called the appeal to universality. That is, when one makes a rational claim, that one makes it from a position of universality. And I definitely agree with that. I have no doubt that contributes to the problem in very serious and substantial way. One of the ways that the youngster would say it is that I'm unique, I'm individual, okay? And this uniqueness and individuality is then used or understood as removing one from the community so that what applies there doesn't apply here. And the traditional way of attacking that is precisely to show that you are no more unique, no less unique than any other given individual, and that if we're going to be rational about this, what applies to you and to you and to me also. And the fact that our age or sex or hair color or length or clothes or whatever is different is not relevant. And only when it is in fact relevant can we claim exemption from that universality. But then anyone else who had that same difference, for example, if being female makes a difference, it makes a difference for every female, okay? And in the same way. Only then would we be able to claim an exemption. And I think that's that characteristic of universality is a necessary characteristic of moral reasoning. But what you point to is a dimension of the problem that I think I am considering, and that is that we have no way of imparting that standard to the youngster. We have no way of teaching that. You can't teach it in the schools. You can't pass it through society in some way. The best I think that can be done with values in the public schools is something equivalent to what they're calling values clarification, which is not moral education at all, and I get extremely rabid when people think that it is. But what it essentially is you clarify what you believe, and you clarify what you believe, and you know, we do exercises to make you real clear about what you think is right or wrong, but we don't do any exercise beyond that to try to determine whether your opinion is superior to your opinion, because we have no grounds for doing that, because that's part of this moral stuff that we can't bring in. That's a serious problem.
Mrs. Yonke.
In that same 14-year-old that maybe doesn't have a moral background in society or in her home, would you consider it pressure to let her know what her options are when she's considering abortion? You're talking about showing her pictures.
I have not, let me say this, I have not read the opinion, the court opinion in that case, okay? And I learned a long time ago that what you don't do is count on any newspaper to ever tell you how it is, okay? And I'm pretty clear about how the decision came down. They can't do it, all right? But I'm not at all clear about what the legal grounds are. But if you ask for my personal opinion about this, it seems to me that it is unconscionable to let a minor make a decision, or let me put it this way, let me reword that, let an immature minor, okay, because I would grant that there's a logical possibility of having a category called mature minors, okay, that means that they're underage but they're competent, okay, because competency,
they're actually knowing what they're doing, what?
Well, surely they know what they're doing, they're not going to have a baby, all right, that's what they know, but if that counts for knowing what you're doing,
but they don't realize what having a baby means, or
well, they don't realize that. That's right, and they also don't realize what abortion itself is. Okay, on both counts, they don't know what they're doing. They don't know what it means to have a baby, and they don't know what it means to have an abortion. And surely they can rattle back the things that they know. I'm going to have to change diapers and get a babysitter, but that's not knowing, as we all know, right? And I'm not sure that age helps that. I think that problem is solved by having a baby, but there is a possibility of having a category of what you would call competent or what the courts call mature minors. We take an immature minor. No, I'll make this stronger. We take anybody, mature or immature. It seems to me that it is the height of irresponsibility to permit them to make a decision without having available to them all the possibilities of their alternatives. and to make known to them what's involved in each.
Adoption or whatever other.
Mm-hmm. Well, not just that, but understanding. For example, I have students in my classes who will say that the fetus is not alive or that the fetus is not human. And there's a biological definitions, right? It is both alive and human, and if it were not human, then we wouldn't have a problem. If it were not alive, we wouldn't have a problem. But I think that this information does need to be made available. Now, why the course decided otherwise, I do not know, and that's just something that I'm going to need to find out.
Professor Abraham,
I have two. They're sort of points and sort of questions. The first is just to describe a different view of what the Supreme Court's decisions on these matters are. That is, your description is, at least in some sense, if I have it right, that the Supreme Court is leaving to the moral domain those issues that are concerned with morality. I think an alternative way of looking at it is to say that the Supreme Court is making moral decisions. After all, liberty or autonomy are pretty important moral values in lots of value schemes, and they may be simply saying that the moral scheme of the Constitution demands that decisions that normally have to do with fundamental liberties remain in the private rather than the legal realm. That's not to say we don't do anything about morality. It's a moral decision, which is here's where we leave this kind of mm-hmm. choice. That means that the Supreme Court isn't saying, well, law does one thing and morality does another. What it says is law takes great account of morality, and what our legal morality tells us is that this kind of decision is for an individual. The Supreme Court might be wrong. That is, other values besides liberty and autonomy might in fact be more important, and therefore you might argue that the Supreme Court decisions on some of these questions are incorrect, but that doesn't make them non-moral decisions.
Right.
The other point is in a way, an empirical one. I suppose it's true that the first value of any polity is to remain together. But my guess, I'm not a historian, but my suspicion is that throughout our history there have been claims that society is falling apart and that we need to have the state involved in more moral regulation so that we don't fall apart. We had Roger Williams leave Massachusetts to found a state. We had cowboys and outlaws. We had rum runners. We had a depression. We had the 60s. You know, the society always stays together. And it may be that in fact the kind of universal rules that are logically implied by philosophical analysis are the ones that are our logical grounding, but that we may not really need them most of the time. That the community, the thing that makes our community is the one value that we all share is a sense that diversity is what makes us work, and that as long as there isn't too much of it, then we don't have to worry that if we had a rule about 14-year-olds, that all 14-year-olds follow, the society would fall apart. Well, if the society was going to fall apart, then we'd have to have a rule that applied to everybody. But as long as it isn't falling apart, then the one thing we can afford is to have some 14-year-olds who don't obey rules that we need to have if everybody felt that way. And that's, you know, we just muddle through that way, and that the moral ground isn't there except for the fact that we all value our own liberty and autonomy, and as long as it doesn't get out of hand, things go forward.
I'll start at the back there. I think that what you say is true, which is why I said I don't want to overstate the case about sowing the seeds of our own destruction. I do think, and I think many people in the human disciplines believe that there is a kind of difference now that we do not know how to evaluate. And that is that people are not living in communities where the social traditional structures have the same kinds of controls that they used to. You don't know your aunts and uncles and cousins and grandmothers and things like that. And that, moreover, the values that are necessary, the values that have at least empirically held together the rural kinds of communities or small town areas are not necessary and are in fact perhaps impossible in large cities unless you have the ghetto kind of situation. So that while the church attendance may be on or off, the fact is that the social pressures that used to set parameters on human behavior don't seem to be there any longer.
Well, some of them aren't, but I pose this as an empirical question, and you might be right, but there are other things that work in the opposite direction. You know, we have mass media, which make people much more, have the same sort of cognitive awareness that it used to be that somebody in Arizona knew about things that were different from somebody in New Hampshire. Now they know the same thing. We have these morality plays that go on once a decade when the president is alleged to have done something wrong. Well, you know, those are just a series of examples. Now, you know, they're going to change people. The kind of morality that people have, the kind of values they have that are generated by that kind of a scheme are different from the kind that are generated by a small town, church-going community, everyone who knows each other. And so there's a substitution of one thing for another, but it doesn't mean that what we had before has disappeared and nothing's come
into place. That's
good. We're getting something different links us together. And it's not clear where that'll come out, but it doesn't mean we're disintegrating. It may just mean we're changing.
Yes, that's good. That's a good point. I think perhaps it's really imperative that we spend a lot more effort trying to analyze what the forces of social cohesion are, since maybe we really don't recognize them. I think that's a very good point. Back to your first point, I really agree entirely with what you said, and I thought I said the same thing in a different way. That is essentially, foundationally, it turns out to be a moral decision. And that fascinates me because it was supposed to be purely objective, rational, and independent of any specific morality, because assuredly there are other ways of understanding the meaning of human life. And any claim that freedom and autonomy is the essential moral characteristic of human beings, not only as identifying them as human beings as such, but that's where the central human project is, it is a moral claim and one that leads, I think, to certain kinds of conclusions.
I have it, Holly, with your a separation, not merely a distinction, but the separation of rationality and morality. I don't quite see why you're doing this exactly. There's certainly not necessarily anything irrational about morality or moral impulses.
I hope not.
But I'd like to illustrate our question that you've raised for us out of another field of law. The California Southern Appellate Division reversed a trial court that dealt with the Bouvier case, a woman who wanted to end her life by self-starvation rather than go on living under extremely difficult and rather hard circumstances. The court, in its decision, said, the appellate court said, it is immoral, I quote the decision, and further, it is monstrous, I quote the decision again, for anybody, physicians, hospitals, or courts, to require somebody to live a life of speculatively 20 years of uncomfortable and really unwelcome pain and discomfort. Now, was the court stepping outside of its proper rhetoric when it used such explicitly ethical and moral terms? Or how would you comment on that? There, it seems to me, we see implicitly in the court's way of handling that case, their opinion, though I'm reading this into their language, expressing their opinion that the distinction or separation in any case of rationality and morality is conceptually impossible and in fact not entertained by the court itself.
Well, I think I believe that, that there is a difference.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that morality... you knew that, yeah.
You made that clear.
I think that maybe the best way of saying it is that morality cannot be irrational, but that it is not exhausted by rationality.
Well, I would agree with you. You were saying that values are essentially subjective and subrational, or something of the kind. I agree with that. There's no rationality that we can use explicitly and carefully to measure the validity, so to speak, of a value.
Mm-hmm.
That's true. But when it comes to the business of deciding how, in terms of human action, we can best serve the values we have adopted, there it seems to me is quite definitely a rational problem.
Yes. I was quick. I thought you were going to say something a little different than you did. I think that it's a moral problem, and that the decision must be a rational decision within the domain of morality, so that I can share it or communicate it with others. But I don't think that it's simply a rational decision. I think that it still would arise out of... The interesting cases, I think, the hard cases, are the ones that illustrate this. Because when you push them back, what you find is that they're hard because people disagree at very fundamental levels. Their fundamental moral insights are what's at issue. And I think the Bouvier case is a very good example. One fundamental moral insight is that forcing someone or not helping someone, and there seems to me to be a difference in that's really important. Not helping someone to be in the world in the way that they essentially choose, in a rational way, because I believe this woman is rational, and that she has made a choice that what she wants to do is to end, at least I thought. It was my understanding that after the decision she said, well, she wasn't really ready to die, and so did not act upon the permission granted her. But at any rate, one group of people is looking there at the life and the quality of the life and the assault on the dignity of the person who's wanting to die. Another person from the other side is looking on the situation and saying, but the essential value here is the value of life itself, and there's something that we betray if we help people to end their lives. And those are incompatible views. And the reasoning that we use tries to cross over them, but I don't think that it ever successfully does. That in the end, if you come out in favor of physicians helping Catherine Bouvier to end her life, that you have that ultimate value, and if I come out against it, that I really am fundamentally asserting the other value.
Well, at least one side has absolutized the value, and the other is relativized.
Yes, that's true. Yes, yes.
And long live relativizing value.
A million copies. General Elliot.
You know, watching society and people individually, I came up with an interrelated mutual self-interest is the glue that keeps people married or then communities together. It isn't a moral decision to have a self-interest. It is a fundamental issue. And mine might be entirely different from yours, but society stays together and groups stay together in all kinds of situations. Combat, for a good example, through interrelated mutual self-interest, and for very despicable reasons, to stay alive. And I've often wondered, as you look at things, where individuals, communities, nations, and interrelationships between nations are all based on interrelated mutual self-interest. You don't need to have an agreement in writing or a marriage certificate or anything else. And those values change people change, communities change, nations change, and then these whole sets of parameters become very pragmatic and practical and amoral, not necessarily moral.
And could we call that the morality of self-interest?
Yeah, I could do that. I think really, Professor Fletcher, that's the area where you were chasing me about separating the rational and the moral. And I think that I do. I would say that what you've said is perfectly rational, and that that's the reasoning which leads to Rawls and Locke and Hobbes giving us the social contract as an epistemological metaphor for understanding the origins of the state. But I find, I think, in many human relationships and in many human experiences, something that really goes beyond that, that it is an essential insight about the necessary relatedness of human beings, how my interest can never be totally separated from the interest of other persons. And I think, for example, of a case that I knew where a child was born mentally and physically handicapped very badly, and the question was, are you going to take the kid home or not? Mom went home. They had a little 6 or 7 year old boy. Mom had just finished law school and had a very nice job in a very nice law firm, and Dad had a nice career, and they had the other little child. And the question was, what are they going to do about this baby? And it was back a long time ago where you could send him off to an institution, and that was relatively common practice, and that was the advice of the physicians. They had even said, don't look at him, you know, just send him off. And I was asked by the attending physician to come and speak with the parents because I have a similar experience in my own life. And I did talk with the people and sort of tried to help them figure out what they wanted to do. Anyway, the short end of the story is that after about, I guess the baby must have been about 5 or 6 weeks old, the dad called me one night at 11:30 and he said, can you meet us at the hospital in the morning at 7? I said, sure. And he said, great, see you then. Well, given what was the matter with the baby, you knew that there was no great cure or, you know, he's not off the critical list or anything like that. I was awake all night. I was at the hospital at 6 asking the nurses, you know, what's going on? In he comes at 7 o'clock with mom and the little boy, and they've got champagne and orange juice and danishes, and they said they've come to take their baby home. And so we had this nice celebration, and they took the baby home, and as he's leaving, I said, excuse me, Jonathan, can we have lunch next week? I would like to know the reasoning process behind this. And he said to me that the night before, he'd put the other son, who was also named Jonathan, to bed, and he'd gone about his business, and he went in to check on the child before he went to bed himself, and little boy was lying there wide awake, and he says, Daddy, if I get real sick, will you send me off to an institution? And Daddy says, no, Jonathan, and we're bringing your brother home tomorrow, okay? And he said that his insight at that time was that even though it was a decided liability, and it has proved to be a decided liability for every single individual member of that family to bring that child home, that it was for the well-being of the family, whatever that is, to bring the child home. And mom lost her career, and Jonathan has this handicapped brother that has to make allowances. You know the stories, how that would go. That seems to me to be the kind of thing that points to an understanding about the way we are with each other, that we are essentially social, that we're not social simply because we recognize that it would be for our benefit to be social, but that there is no way to escape the fact that we are fundamentally related to each other and that our well-being is tied together in a profoundly fundamental way that cannot simply be explained by my pursuing my own self-interest. And I don't know which is right. I just know that I am very fascinated with this other way of looking at it, and I call the way you look at it very rational, because it really is and the way I look at it, I recognize, is not exhausted by rationality.
Well, the final chapter in the interrelated mutual self-interest, I've seen people give up their lives
exactly
to the benefit of those that they had what you call a moral contract.
But how is it in your self-interest to, for example, if you could buy off the draft and let somebody else fight the war, how is it in your self-interest to go and die? Why isn't it in your self-interest to pay the other guy to go?
Well, in a lot of cases, that's happened.
Oh, I know, but...
Yeah, but I miss your point.
Well...
You've got a point, and I missed it cold.
Okay, you were saying that you see people in their own self-interest give up their life for their country, or for their family, or for others. Mm. It's not clear to me that it's in that person's self-interest. He's dead.
He judges it to be.
Oh, it's for the sake of posterity. And as Shaw said, you know, posterity never did anything for me. Why should I do anything for posterity?
That's true.
Well, that's radical individualism.
Can I conclude from that this family, in your judgment, in making that decision, was irrationally moral?
Well, I think it's non-rational. I don't think it's irrational. I guess I would say that irrational contradicts the standards of rationality. But non-rational means it simply goes outside.
Right. Well, if you go back to your examples, we know, too, that I've seen it happen. People in walls think together. But people also throw themselves on a grenade, which is completely irrational.
Right.
But it's moral, I suppose you'd say.
Yeah, I would say it's non-rational. I would say the person's not crazy to do that. It's not irrational, but it's non-rational. That is, he holds a value outside of those values that can be understood within the concept
rare,
of rationality.
To hold that kind of value. Maybe precious.
It is.
We have too
little
of that now.
I think so.
Well, why is it a moral judgment to take, for this family, to take the baby home? How do you define morality to fit that sort of a episode? Basically, it's a decision that they make for their own benefit, basically. It isn't a moral decision, because why is there a moral fact? What is the moral factor that you can apply to it?
Oh, well, maybe we have a need to look at moral as opposed to immoral and moral as opposed to non-moral. Okay, whether it's morally right or morally wrong, the word moral has two contraries. Okay, one of them is we're talking about a moral issue here, like whether or not they will take the baby home. It seems to me to be a moral issue. I'll say why in just a minute. That's a moral issue. They can decide this and it's morally right, or they can decide that and it's morally wrong. Okay, or whether, do the easy one, whether or not to take the $5 that's laying on the table when we all leave and I'm the last one out of the room, is a moral question. I can be morally right in responding to it or morally wrong in responding to it, okay? Whether I will have chocolate or strawberry ice cream is a non-moral question, okay? The issue of morality just doesn't arise. Now, I think that the issue about whether or not to take the baby home is a moral issue, because this is how I understand morality. I believe that moral decisions are those decisions that we make that form us as a definitive person with a character or a way of being in the world that is identifiable as our own, so that it becomes a broad category for me that I would leave a profession to become a philosophy student and hopefully a philosophy professor was a moral decision to me. Now, there's a level on which whether you work for IBM or Xerox is not really a moral question. It could be a moral question whether you work for an arms manufacturer or a
Salvation Army.
The Salvation Army. Good, thanks. Okay. Okay. That could be, under certain circumstances, that could be a moral question. But in general, our choice of profession is, you know, but when I say I am a teacher and I am a scholar and that's who I have to be, I'm forming myself in a certain way to be a certain kind of person, to live in the world in a certain way, so that when you point to me, you can say, that's who she is. And I regard a decision about whether or not, or I regard a decision about a response to the given tragic fact of a handicapped child as that kind of a decision. It says who you are in the world. And I think that's what Jonathan Senior saw in that. He saw that he was going to be a father who abandoned his child if he let that kid go to an institution. And he couldn't live with that when he realized that Jonathan Jr. would see it that same way.
But also he surrogated to himself a decision which basically affected the life of other people much more than the life of the child. I mean the disabled child, because under the circumstances, the disabled child presumably would not be with it. But what he was doing was seriously impacting the life of two other people, that is his wife and his older child. And mm-hmm. I wonder if that isn't, he didn't do it out of a matter of moral judgment, but more out of kind of a self-satisfaction. I think it's a kind of a vicious type of decision rather than a moral decision.
You mean it might be a morally wrong decision? It could be a morally wrong decision, yes. But it is a moral decision in the sense of moral as opposed to non-moral. It's definitely a moral question, what he's going to do about that. It could be either morally right then or morally wrong. It definitely could be. I have seen situations in which people have tried to care for the handicapped or the aged or, you know, whatever the sad circumstances of their lives, and have been unable to rise to the occasion, and that choice has been very destructive of their lives and the lives of others in their home, and that's entirely possible. Once he makes that decision, he's only just begun. Now he's got to do it right. You know, now he has got to be a father to that family and make the living of that value, because that's a value he chooses. He chooses the value of being family over the value of reducing his burdens and reducing the burdens of his wife and son. The value of family was a higher value, and that's what I mean about being able to identify him. He's the person who chose family over self and over the selves of the individuals in that case.
I think that second is the more important, because he can make the decision for himself any way he wants, but all the way through all of these decisions, I think the important thing is the way they impact on other people.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. Yeah, it's true.
Don't you think that the word morality somehow connotes either a connection with religion or spirituality, or the rules that come down through a form of religion?
I think for people who don't do philosophy, that is definitely true. And even among those of us who do have the philosophical grounding to try to understand morality as an essentially rational enterprise, we often find that our own religious values are the most important or the most determinative element in our own private moral decisions. That's decidedly true. Because assuredly, each religious heritage has its own sort of moral code accompanying it. But one of the wonderful things about life after the Enlightenment is that we're able to try to find some common moral values that we can live with, so that we're not killing each other over whether or not there's a Trinity or Christ is the Son of God or Holy Man or, you know, however that goes, and that we can work in community apart from the definitive particularistic religious beliefs. And except for those people like the Amish or the Quakers who are somewhat separatists who try to remove themselves from the influences of that secular humanism, the predominating moral concerns, I think, need to be worked out in public independent of the individual commitments that we have to our religious beliefs.
Well, I sort of wanted the decision of taking the child home might not have been that this is the baby that was given to me, I have an obligation to do it, that sort of thing, as being a moral.
It could have been. And some people would definitely look at it that way. And other people, one of the common things I hear now from people who do not take the children home, or people who are talking about refusing treatment for handicapped infants with the object that they will then die, is that I do not choose to have that kind of a baby, and my choice is what's fundamentally important. And with the others, there may be sort of an acceptance of what is given and working from that which is given.
Victor Yonke, maybe one or two more.
I want to take something from apart from what you've been recently discussing, perhaps in the abstract. But down through history, for centuries, you have minorities who take a same moral position, not a tiny minority, take the same moral position, and they're not protected against the tyranny of the majority. Now, how can you protect that? Because maybe a decade or a generation later, those people were right. And history took a disastrous course. Now, how can you protect that minority? They're not fanatics, but they're a moral position based on whatever you might want to place it, Ten Commandments or morality itself. We've seen so much of it, where the majority is either misinformed, ill-informed, and other people suffer.
Well, I think one of the glories of being an American lies precisely in the fact that we have a structure that enables us to protect. It doesn't guarantee that we're going to, all right? But it does enable us to protect the minorities. Not only those that are right, but also those that are wrong. And I think that one of the very scary things about democracy is the power of the majority. You know, it's the sort of bandwagon phenomenon that we all know, and that combined with the peer pressure and all the, you know, the sociological and the psychological concepts that all amount to the same thing, that once you've got momentum, you know, you seem to gather more. That's a very frightening aspect of it, but if we are truly humble in our politics, and that's something that I will address this afternoon, that if we are truly humble in our politics, both in our theoretical and our practical politics, we will always admit the possibility that we're wrong. And the very admission of that possibility will always keep us open to listening to genuinely hearing the other, in the hopes that we can then continue to seek rightness, truth, good behavior, good social arrangements, that kind of thing. That's a scarce commodity. Scarce in my classroom, scarce in my neighborhood. It's scarce everywhere. But it seems to me that that's one of the fundamental kinds of things that we ought to be seeking in our political relationships. And if you ask me how can I secure it, I think the best security is to continue to enable people to have that kind of humility. Because you can only have it if people aren't going to trounce you. You know, I mean, you can only be humble in a position where you do not need to be exerting power. So the community itself needs to be open to the possibility of its own error, and at the same time working towards the beauty of the vision that it has. You don't say, well, I'm humble, I'm going to sit still. You say, I'm humble, so I'm going to pursue this goal, meanwhile taking into account alternative kinds of views. There's no way to guarantee that people will be good, you know, and that you're talking there about essential goodness. And the best guarantee that we can have is that we continue to try to form an environment that makes it possible for people to be good. It's a very hopeless answer.
I hope all of you will want to hear more and think more about this subject at 4 o'clock this afternoon and in the Dome Room. Professor Jordan will talk about democracy and the Constitution. in words, deeds, practices, as she has this more theoretical subject. She started us in this overall interest we've had in rhetoric and at least beginning to probe the subject of legal and moral reasoning, and if we have one or two other sessions as good as this one, I think we will have made a lot of progress in thinking about some of the fundamental issues. Thank you very much, and thank you.